Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event in association with the Leonardo da Vinci Society and Humanities West. And we'd really like to welcome Michael Stare to give his talk on Bernini's Rome, Gian Lorenzo Bernini, Michelangelo of the Baroque. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Lord. Before Michael begins, I would actually like Laura Waste, a board member of the Leonardo da Vinci Society, to introduce Michael, because I don't know him.
Well, if anyone is worth introducing, Laura, Michael.
Laura, the microphone.
I would like to again greet our Consul General of Italy, Mauro Battocchi, and Paolo Barlera from the Italian Cultural Institute. Thank you for coming and being here. And I'd like to greet our members of the Leonardo da Vinci Society who have come here this evening. And I want to thank Patricia Lundborg and George Hammond from Humanities West and the Commonwealth Club for arranging our being here tonight. And now Michael Stare and his awaited program on Bernini. Michael received his degree in art history from Stanford in 1991 with a focus on Michelangelo and interior church painting in the era of the Baroque. Professionally, Michael runs a decorative arts business, executing custom hand-painted residential finishes. He's also an artist himself and leads art-focused tours to France and Italy. This evening, Michael will take us to Rome to explore the artistic achievements of Gian Lorenzo Bernini as he considers the compliment given to Bernini by a contemporary of his who named him as the Michelangelo of the Baroque. Michael, our pleasure.
Thank you, Laura, for that kind introduction, and many thanks to the Leonardo da Vinci Society and the Commonwealth Club for hosting the event here this evening. Very grateful for an opportunity to accompany you once again on a virtual journey to our beloved Rome. Today we have one of the better topics when one's considering a virtual journey to Rome, and that is the life, the work of Gian Lorenzo Bernini. Certainly one of the giants of the age of the Baroque, really considered one of the founders of the Baroque style, along with Pietro da Cortona, Francesco Borromini, and Caravaggio. And an artist whose work just really seems to dominate Rome. It doesn't matter where you are in the Eternal City, it seems like you're always a stone's throw away from one of his major masterpieces. You just can't escape him when you tour the city. I know that when I take my groups to visit Rome, it feels like that name is always coming out, Gian Lorenzo Bernini. So certainly one of the giants of the age of the Baroque, and for anyone who wants to consider the beautiful art that we go to see when we go to Rome. And it was in the early 1620s that Bernini was paid the ultimate compliment when Maffeo Barberini, who would emerge as Pope Urban VIII, dubbed him the Michelangelo of the Baroque, the ultimate compliment. And really, this is a commentary on Bernini's incredible range, his ability to flourish in multiple branches of the arts. In fact, it was the great Florentine Michelangelo Buonarroti, the hero of the Renaissance, who separates himself from all his peers, all his contemporaries, and all artists that would follow him by executing universally regarded masterpieces in three branches of the arts. If we consider the art of painting, Michelangelo's fresco on the Sistine ceiling is regarded by some as the greatest artistic achievement, period. So, universally regarded masterpiece, of course, on the ceiling and then on the back wall in 1535 with the Last Judgment. And then, of course, in the art of architecture, Michelangelo is credited with the design of the Dome of St. Peter's, said to be the most copied architectural element in the history of Western culture. So these aren't lesser known masterpieces. These are page one, I like to call page one masterpieces in their art. And then regarding his sculptural masterpieces, there's too numerous to name here. But of course, one of my favorites is what you encounter when you enter the Basilica San Pietro, the first chapel to the right, where you see his lovely Pietà, quintessential Renaissance sculpture. But then we have in the 1620s, Bernini is starting to emerge in his early 20s, about 110 years after the unveiling of the Sistine ceiling. And Bernini arrives to make contributions in multiple branches of the arts. In architecture, in the 1650s, it's Fabio Chigi, Pope Alexander VII, that charges Bernini with the task of both enclosing the large piazza in front of San Pietro, enclosing the piazza, giving it form, but also welcoming the millions of pilgrims that come every year. So think about that, enclosing but welcoming. There's a contradiction there, and Bernini arrives at the wonderful, my laser light's not going to work on that screen, huh? Bernini arrives at that wonderful double colonnade, which greets us every time we step into the Vatican City State, regarded by almost everyone, a perfect resolution of this challenge to give form and structure to the space while maintaining a degree of welcome with the church and the arms of the colonnade extending from the facade of that building to embrace the pilgrims that come every day. And then regarding sculpture, this is a sculpture that we're going to talk about in more detail in a moment. But Bernini, with his Apollo and Daphne, pushes the stone to a degree that it begins to contradict what we expect from that cold, brittle material. He's fashioning it more like a baker would fashion dough than an artist would shape a stone out of a chisel and a hammer. So here he challenges us with sculpture that's really rivaling painting with its animation, with its movement, with its detail. And here, Bernini really sets himself apart from his contemporaries in the handling of the stone. But when we begin to look more closely at Bernini the man and Bernini the body of work, we begin to see that he really serves, in some regards, as a departure from Michelangelo. Despite the calling by Urban VIII to as this Michelangelo of the age of the Baroque, Urban VIII encourages Bernini to develop his painting so he could more completely fulfill that role. He devotes about 2 years of his career to develop this technique. It executes about 150 paintings, but almost all of them are lost. None of them rise to the rank of masterpiece. However, he does display a dexterity with the tools and with the materials, because what we're looking at here is a self-portrait. All right, but never to the lofty status that we associate with Michelangelo. And again, unlike Michelangelo with his notable, fiery, and combustible temperament, you know, you see the word in the research, terribile, that he had this fierceness about him that had him at odds with his patrons more often than not, we see in Bernini a social grace, an eloquence, that endeared him to his clients, had him traveling amongst the papal courts where his greatest patrons were with great ease. He wore silks rather than work clothes, and it was this temperament of Bernini's which really allowed him to cement himself as arguably the greatest artistic talent of his century. Now, what I'd like to begin with here is a description of Bernini the man, both physical and his sort of his nature, before we begin to consider his work in particular. Now, Gian Lorenzo Bernini, born in 1598, dies in 1680. So he lives to the age of 82. I mean, he must have looked like Father Time to his contemporaries. Consider that Michelangelo outdoes him by 7 years, lives to the age of 89. So just by their tenure on this planet, we see two men who are really separating themselves from their peers, not only just their peers, but from all their contemporaries as well. Regarded in a lot of research as the greatest artistic talent of his century, and regarded by some as the greatest man of his century. Boy, incredible designation. And again, we're talking about this incredible range that he displays with his achievements and with his life. He was a playwright, set designer, sculptor, architect, ambassador, diplomat, and those are 2 points that we're going to conclude with tonight. So we're seeing that it's just an incredible range, and a lot of this is due to because of that grace that he displays, that eloquence that separates him from Michelangelo. The research also notes that he was of swashbuckling good looks. swashbuckling good looks. I remember when I read that, I made a special note. What are swashbuckling good looks? You know, so I turned to the only people I could turn to with a question like that, and that would be the women in my household, which would be my 13-year-old daughter and my wife. And for them, swashbuckling good looks means Johnny Depp. I mean, both their hearts are a flutter to Johnny Depp. I don't look a thing like him, so I don't know what my wife sees in me. But for that age group, Johnny Depp qualifies swashbuckling good looks. But I wanted to go a little bit further, knowing that we were going to have a wide demographic here. And I thought, well, maybe Errol Flynn fits in. Did I even hear a name? I thought I might have even heard Errol Flynn's name called out. Listen, who cares about how good looking he is? If you can pull off the gold shoulder tassel like that, I mean, you've got a skill set that's rivaling Gian Lorenzo Bernini. That's quite a look there. So again, swashbuckling good looks, that also identifies them as possibly one of the greatest child prodigies in the history of Western art. And that's quite a statement, because we find that these artistic giants, they show their unique ability at a very young age. And it says that at the age of 8, that he was already sculpting full-size human heads out of blocks of marble. The age of 8. You know, I don't know how that strikes you, but I'm only 2 years removed from having an 8-year-old in my house. My son Jack is 10. I took this picture of him when he was 8. And I'm telling you, at the time that he was 8, he was still about 60% knucklehead, 40% sweetheart. Okay? And his greatest achievements are what he could fashion out of Legos. And he's holding up with great pride his Lego helicopter there. So the idea of beautiful Jackie forming something as sophisticated as a human form out of a block of stone, that unforgiving material of stone, to me is just dazzling. And I think that's one of those indications of the unique talents that we're talking about when we consider these giants in art history. Now, I'd like to proceed with more physical descriptions of Bernini, because, again, they give us insight into the man and this energy that was coursing through his veins. And this description comes from an account that was written during a trip to France when he was in his 60s. And the account lists that he was of modest height, that he was thin, that his temperament was all fire. And when we consider his sculpture, I think, and his architecture, I think we're going to sense that fire in his work. That he had eagle-like face and eyes. My goodness, we can see that clearly in the portrait. That he was energetic, and he was always looking for a chance to resist the ride in his carriage. If he could walk it, he wanted to walk. He didn't want to sit in that box and be pulled along by a horse. That he had a fabulous memory, a lively imagination, and he was an acute conversationalist. I mean, I read this account, and I wanted to see if I could have this guy over for dinner. He sounds like the perfect dinner guest, and boy, the questions that I can bombard Bernini with would be fabulous. And then lastly, a quick glimpse into his artistic principles of success. He was asked, what does it take to be a successful artist? And I think that, again, this gives us insight into the man. He had 3 points. First, immerse yourself in the beauty of antiquity. Okay, some artists have egos that are so big that's not cool. I'm not going to, you know, that's a crutch. I'm not going to lean on any of my predecessors. I'm too good. I'm too big. I'm not going to do that. He says, point number 2, to work hard. Okay, value of hard work. And point number 3, get good criticism. These are Bernini's 3 points of being a successful artist. And from these 3 points, I glean the fact that Bernini, despite his incredible skill and his swashbuckling good looks, was very humble. Someone who's willing to take get good criticism. Do you think Michelangelo was eager to get good criticism? No, probably not. And I think there'd be many artists that would be in that category, because artists are inherently insecure. You know, 2 + 2 doesn't always equal 4. There's not these rigid rules that define art. And so all of us, and I include myself in that grouping, we're just ravaged with insecurity. And we're going to see Bernini was as well from time to time. That he was disciplined, a very hard worker. We all respect people who are willing to work hard. And that he was very respectful of his predecessors. Again, this sort of plays into that spirit of celebrating his humility, being humble. So all of a sudden, when we consider the artistic talent, we consider the social grace, we consider the humility, it doesn't seem to be that big of a stretch to say Gian Lorenzo Bernini, the greatest man of his century. So we're seeing that this is a unique individual with a very impressive resume. Now, if Bernini stands as one of the great giants of the Baroque, and we're comparing him or likening him to the hero of the High Renaissance, Michelangelo, I thought it would be interesting to spend just a moment comparing two works of art by each artist of the same subject. So we're going to talk first about Michelangelo and his triumphant rendering of the David that you'll see at the Accademia when you visit Firenze. And it doesn't matter how many times you've seen this image on the slide wall or in a book, it has a way of sort of dominating you when you encounter it in person. Its scale, the fierce quality of the gaze, it has a physical presence that really has a way of sort of dominating you when you encounter it in person. And Michelangelo's David says so much about the Renaissance ideals and the way it's handled. Michelangelo is depicting David at the moment immediately prior to his engagement, physical engagement with the giant Philistine Goliath. The slingshot is over his shoulder. The stone is in his right hand. And so we have here a depiction of this calm before this great flurry of physical and emotional energy. And so here Michelangelo has depicted David at a moment of grace, of quietude, of sobriety, of elegance. And these are all the values, all the themes that we associate with Renaissance art. But if we move the timeline about 120 years, we see the values, we see themes, we see techniques drastically changing. Here is Gian Lorenzo Bernini's sculpture of the David that you'll encounter during that wonderful visit of the Galleria Borghese. And when you step into the room where the David is displayed, we find David depicted in this instantaneous snapshot of motion, of animation, of movement. And it's Bernini's attempt to display truth through the instantaneous, the momentary. And he's got his body completely spun around. The slingshot is cocked in his hand, ready to deliver the stone that will disable the giant Philistine. And when you step into this room and we see the posture of David, you're convinced that the giant Goliath is in that room with you. And the viewer is tempted to duck to make sure that the stone doesn't strike you in the forehead and drop you to the ground. So here it's all the age of the Baroque. The David is all about movement. It's all about animation. It's all about drama. It's all about theater. And these are the hallmarks of Bernini's work and hallmarks of the age of the Baroque. The lore of this sculpture has it that Maffeo Barberini, who again would elevate to the status as Pope Urban VIII, one of Bernini's great patrons, held a mirror for Gian Lorenzo as he positioned his own face to serve as the guide for the face of David with the lips pursed together, again depicting this instantaneous moment where all this strength, all this psychological energy is coming together for this incredible physical challenge that he's facing. An interesting note about this fabulous sculpture executed by Bernini when he was in his, you know, early to mid-20s, that he would say later that this sculpture brought him a great degree of sadness at the end of his life. And I remember thinking, God, how could that be? This incredible achievement should bring him only joy as he recounted it. But he saw a work like this being so excellent, executed so early in his life, and he felt that he progressed so little during his career. So we see this from artists as they're their hardest critics, and it's so rare that they are able to enjoy their own work. Now, we're going to go ahead and proceed with addressing some of Bernini's work in particular as we engage in this virtual journey of beautiful Rome and set up this comparison with Michelangelo. But I'm going to go ahead and state here that it was only about a year ago that I addressed the Leonardo da Vinci Society, and I gave a lecture entitled St. Peter's Basilica, Greatest Landmark in Western Culture. And so I didn't want to be redundant this evening, so I'm actually going to exclude all of Bernini's work in the Basilica, which occupied off and on of over 50 years of his career. So the fact that I'm able to exclude that and still, I'll have somebody getting ready to turn the lights out on me here at the end of my 50-minute lecture, that still have plenty to fill this lecture, again, is a testimony to this incredible, very productive body of work that Bernini executed during his lifetime. So our first stop this evening, now that we consider the work specifically, is actually one of the first stops that I make when I bring my groups to Rome, and that is to consider his fountain at the center of the Piazza Navona. Some of you might roll your eyes, feeling that it is just so touristy. But the reason why there's so many tourists there is it's just such a fabulous setting with the silhouette of Borromini Sanignese, the most prominent architectural element. And then, Bernini's Fontana dei Quattro Fiumi, marking the center of the piazza. Now, probably Bernini's most celebrated fountain, it's interesting to note that it was actually also his most unlikely fountain design, because it came about at the low point of his career. Bernini was fresh from his bell tower fiasco on the facade of St. Peter's, where he was erecting bell towers that were called by Carlo Moderno, his initial design for the facade, and he was working on the south tower, and cracks began to form at the foundation of the facade. And Bernini was ordered to remove the tower at his own expense, a horrible sign of disrespect at that time. So fresh from this failure, Pope Innocent X, the Pamphili Pope, was committed not to use Bernini on this project. Excuse me. But Bernini knew that this would be the perfect opportunity to reset, to reassert his reputation in the art circles of Rome. So he approached a mutual friend of both his and the Pamphili Pope, Innocent X, Cardinal Ludovisi, and he said, do you have any thoughts on how I could get my foot in the door on this project? And Ludovisi nodded and said, yes, you come up with a little bozzetto, a modello, a little study, a clay study, terracotta study, for what you would propose for this fountain. I'll make sure the Pope sees it. So Bernini executes this little bozzetto, this little approximation, a study for what he would propose for the Four Rivers Fountain. Ludovisi takes it, sneaks it into the papal apartment, and sets it on a side table where the Pope is certain to encounter it. And the Pope does, actually, in the company of Ludovisi, and upon seeing it, says, my goodness, Cardinal, this would be the perfect design for the fountain for the center of the Piazza Navona. Whose hand is it by? Ludovisi shrugs his shoulders and says, well, Your Excellency, this is by Bernini. And he says, oh, feigns displeasure. The only way not to use a design by Bernini is to not to see a design by Bernini. So the commission was his. So what are we looking at here? First, let's get into the storytelling that Bernini is embarking on with the iconography of the Four Rivers Fountain. And this is a wonderful story with this element, so you're going to have to give me a little bit of room here as I lay this wonderful tale and the storytelling out here before you. First, we have this vertical element, the obelisk, a recently unearthed obelisk in the 17th century, an Egyptian motif which translates to finger of the sun. Obelisk, finger of the sun. So you've got this element, this soaring vertical element, which is bringing light from the heavens down to earth. And the allegory or the iconography of the symbolism of light, spiritual enrichment, spiritual energy, coming down on this vertical element down to the ground below. At the very top, you can make out the Pamphili dove and olive branch, and the dove is the symbol of the Holy Spirit in the Christian tradition, holding the olive branch, which is the symbol of peace. So you have all this, the spiritual energy of light, the symbol of the Holy Spirit, coming down the obelisk, down to this very rough-looking island or rock formation, travertine rock formation, that makes up its base. And on each corner of the rock formation are four colossal, reclining nude male figures. And ever since the 5th century BC in the Parthenon, the reclining male nude is a personification of a river. So at the base, you see these four figures, and this is one of my photographs where you can see this wonderful luminous light illuminating the travertine stone. Each one of these figures represents one of the then known four great rivers of the world. So we have a geographic play of universality that's being told here. The first figure we're going to consider is the one in the center. That is the figure representing the Ganges. And each one of these figures is displayed with attributes which help tie it to its location. And the figure representing the Ganges has this long oar that he holds that comes up right beyond his knee. And that refers to the vast navigable length of the Ganges River. If we look to the left, we see the figure of the Danube, who represents Europe, the personification of Europe. And he reaches up, and he's actually straightening the papal escutcheon. You can see at the top the papal tiara and the cross keys, and then the Pamphili escutcheon below. And here's a reference to Europe's role as guiding the church, because the center of the church, of course, was in Europe, in Rome. Here's another slide that gives you a detailed view of the figure representing the Danube, providing that guidance. If we go to the other side of the stone formation, we see this draped figure representing the Nile and the continent of Africa. And in a clever allusion to a characteristic of the Nile, Bernini drapes the face of this figure as a reference to the fact that at this point, the water source of the Nile was still unknown. So this is, again, a very playful, very clever way of identifying this form with the Nile River. And then behind him, we have the last figure to consider. That was the figure representing the Rio Plate, which would be the personification of the New World. And this is a very exotic-looking form with the curled beard, the bald head, with the ankle jewelry that's lifted up onto his shin. And he repels backward with his fingers splayed in a gesture that is sort of in awe of this spiritual force and gloria that's emerging from the top of the obelisk and the Holy Spirit, the dove. Now, there's a tour guide's tale that says that this figure is actually repelling in fear that Borromini's facade of San Ignace is poorly designed and about to topple upon him. If you look at the dates, that story doesn't hold up very well with the design of the fountain and Borromini's involvement with that church. But also, you know, Bernini was a man of a degree of grace where I don't see him letting something petty like that dominate the handling of a major element of this fountain. It still makes for excellent storytelling, but I'm in the camp that says that he's actually repelling back in awe of this spiritual fury that he's perceiving from the top of the obelisk. So in sum, what do we have? What's the poetry that Bernini is communicating to us with his Four Rivers Fountain? Well, we have, again, it's this play of universality of the Christian faith, this dove, this light that comes down from the obelisk and is spread out through the four corners of the world. This idea of the waters emerging from the church. And remember, in the Christian tradition, water has this symbolic quality of rejuvenating the spirit, initiating the spirit, revitalizing the soul, and all of that is coming down the obelisk and spreading out through the four great rivers of the world to nourish all those who are willing to make themselves accessible to it. Now, my last two stories about the Four Rivers Fountain before we move on regard first its unveiling. When it was close to completion, Innocent X got 50 of his closest friends, lucky to have 50 close friends, and leads from the family palazzo, which is right there on the piazza, to the fountain. They approach Gian Lorenzo, and Pope Innocent requests, you know, Gian Lorenzo, could we see water go through the fountain? I can tell you're almost finished. And Bernini shakes his head and says, oh, Your Excellency, I have to apologize. We're not quite there yet, and I would have needed a little bit more notice to accommodate you. Understanding but disappointed, Innocent X turns to walk away, and at that precise moment, Bernini looks to his foreman, gives him the prearranged signal, and hundreds of gallons of water begin to flow through the fountain. Sensing the movement, hearing the sound, Innocent X turns around, and with great joy he says, Gian Lorenzo, with the happiness you've brought me here today, you have added at least 10 years to my life. Not a bad feather to have in your cap to lengthen the life of the person on earth who's theoretically closest to Jesus. However, it's only here where we find out that the limitations of Bernini's powers, because Innocent would pass 2 years later. Now, the last note, again, about the Four Rivers Fountain speaks to the artistic temperament. Gian Lorenzo Bernini, one of the most celebrated fountains in all of Rome. The age of the Baroque was the age of fountains in Rome. Gian Lorenzo Bernini, so disgusted with how this fountain turned out, that every time he passed it in his carriage, he insisted on pulling his shade down. And it speaks to the inability of artists to separate the final work from the endless paths not taken. The artist, we just take the work for what it is, but the artist has all these alternative designs and paths not taken that he can't turn off. And he always thinks that there was a better opportunity, a better resolution to some of the design challenges. So this is partially why artists have such a difficult time enjoying their own work, because they can't make that distinction, they can't make that separation. All right, now we're going to take a short little cab ride from the Piazza Navona and head up to the Galleria Borghese, the Villa Borghese, where we get to consider really the high point of the handling of marble sculpture by Bernini, again where he pushes the stone to its absolute extremes, and he dazzles us with the handling of the material, where the limitations for Bernini aren't the tools, aren't the materials, it's merely his imagination. Whatever he can dream up, he can find a way to execute. Here specifically, we're going to talk about one of my favorite pieces, and that's a quotation from Ovid's Metamorphosis, where we have telling the story of Apollo, who is this sort of Tom Cruise of the Roman gods, usually depicted with nearly feminine good looks, and he had a resume that was extremely impressive, where he's the god of light, god of the sun, god of poetry, god of music, god of archery, goes on and on. But he had the misfortune or the bad judgment one day to make fun of the archery skills of Cupid, Apollo did. And Cupid didn't take kindly to this, so he reaches back into his quiver and he pulls out one of his gold-tipped arrows of love and sinks it right into Apollo. Well, there's no problem with that. Apollo probably was grateful for that. However, he had one more arrow in that quiver, and it was the cold, lead-tipped arrow of unrequited love. And he found Apollo, the object of Apollo's obsession, Daphne, and he sinks into her that lead-tipped arrow that meant no matter how handsome he was, no matter how impressive his resume was, that she was never going to return his feelings. But that didn't keep Apollo from trying, and he would pursue and pursue. And then finally, at the moment that he thinks he finally has her, Daphne calls up to the Roman gods and pleads, please change the form of this body that has brought attention from far too many. And at that precise moment that Apollo thinks he finally has her, her body morphs into a laurel tree. And it's hard to know what is more impressive. Is it the god's ability to turn flesh into a tree? Or is it Bernini's ability to turn stone into flesh that's morphing into a tree? If you look carefully, the image isn't quite big enough, but you can see roots extending from her toes. You can see the bark extending from the ground and preparing to envelop her legs and her torso. You can see from her fingertips branches and leaves beginning to extend. In the Metamorphosis, it says that when Apollo reached her, that he could still feel her heart beating through the bark. And when I visit Apollo and Daphne at the Galleria Borghese, I mean, gosh, I want to touch the stone because I feel like I could feel the heart beating through the stone as well. If we look at this close-up here, we get a better appreciation of the incredible dexterity of Bernini. Again, remember that comment that I made, where the only limitation is his imagination. So in control of the tools and materials. And for me, that's just exhilarating. See, here the leaves would be executed with a hand-powered drill that would bore in and out of the stone to remove material, because any tap with a mallet and a chisel, and if it's misplaced, you could lose a week's worth of work with leaves and branches popping off. Again, that depiction of the instantaneous, truth through the momentary, through the instantaneous, and the instantaneous nature of this moment is depicted by Daphne's hair, where she's trying to elude Apollo, and all of a sudden, boom, she's frozen, the roots go, the bark comes up, and the hair, see the hair, continues forward. And it's that detail of the hair that really underscores the instantaneous freezing that occurs when the gods answer her plea. Now, why would a sculpture like this even be executed, you know, telling this pagan tale during the Counter-Reformation? Well, really, there's a morality play at work here where this piece decorating the Villa Borghese would sort of be a piece of propaganda for the Borghese family. And the virtues being extolled here are laid out on the base of this piece. a sequence that was fashioned by Maffeo Barberini. The name comes up again, who saw himself as the poet pope when he was Urban VIII. And the saying goes, that's inscribed there on the base, is all those who seek feeding pleasures of the senses will have their hands filled with nothing but leaves. And so the idea of having this piece in the Borghese home would be that they would want those virtues, those morals, associated with their family and with the papacy of Pope Paul V, Camillo Borghese. I mean, we could lose ourselves in the Galleria Borghese. We're going to bypass some of my favorite work there in the interest of time. And we're going to head upstairs to consider the portrait bust of Scipione Borghese. This work celebrated from its creation as one of the greatest portrait busts ever. Now, you'll find if you study the work of Michelangelo, no portrait busts in his body of work. He resisted doing portraits in stone because his comment was, if you cover a baker in flour, he doesn't look like the same baker anymore. So it was too difficult to achieve the likeness. However, this piece is a near speaking likeness. I mean, look at the lips are spread just in a moment of conversation. And it's an incredible likeness of this celebrated cardinal who was said to take the art of gravy training the family name to new heights. He never got beyond cardinal, but it was still recognized in the research that he was very adept at using that family name to get what he needed. However, when this piece was nearing completion, a weakness, a flaw in the stone emerges at the very end of the project, where a misplaced mallet strike causes a fissure to appear across the forehead of Scipione Borghese, making the piece a practical loss. So Bernini takes it to completion and then immediately embarks on a replica. The research says that the replica took 15 days to complete, which seems pretty quick. There's a second account that says that the replica took 3 days to complete. Now, interesting, of course, but specifically, what does that tell us? That tells us that the production, the technical work, the mechanical work of the artist is really the minimal concern. He had the creative work done with the first version, and then on the second version, only the mechanical work was left. And it just shows us that in evaluating art, in celebrating art, it's the creative element of the art that needs to be most celebrated. There's lots of wonderful craftsmen, but it's the artists whose brains are out in front of everyone else. Those are the ones that we celebrate in the history of art. Now, at this point, when it comes to the unveiling, Bernini takes the second version, puts it aside, takes the flawed version and puts it out in front of Scipione Borghese. And then when the cardinal comes for the unveiling, pulls the drapery off, and feigning an incredible amount of pride with this finished work. And Scipione is sort of uneasy because, of course, he sees the glaring flaw across the forehead. And the account says that Bernini drew this out till it was pure agony before finally going to the second version and pulling the drapery off of that one. So again, this was to great cheers of everyone that were in attendance. So again, this is another situation where Bernini displays a flair for drama and theater in a manner which sort of charmed his clients, his patrons, which only served to earn him more, bolster his reputation and earn him more opportunities in the future. These busts are almost side by side on the second floor of the Galleria Borghese. Show of hands of people who have seen these in person? Okay, so about half, a little more than half the room possibly. Okay, our next stop, we're going to regrettably leave the Galleria Borghese, and we're going to head to the top of the Quirinale Hill, where we're going to consider a work that is part architecture, part sculpture, and that's the genius of Bernini. When you consider the Baldacchino and San Pietro, you don't know if you're looking at sculpture or architecture. And likewise, when you consider the ecstasy of Santa Teresa of Avila in Santa Maria della Vittoria, what you see here, Bernini working with architectural elements, with sculptural elements in this symphony of forms and materials that we associate with the age of the Baroque. Here, Bernini is telling the story of the Carmelite nun, Santa Teresa of Avila, who lived mid-1500s, a great reformer during the Counter-Reformation. And what's most notable about Santa Teresa is that she had a revelation, an experience, an intense interaction with God, with the Holy Spirit, which she chronicled herself. And this is the subject of the sculptural group that we see. We see the sculptural group placed in the middle of this audicula, this curvilinear audicula with the polychrome marbles. We see at the top there a hidden light source. I was hunched down to take this photograph, but if you stand normally in the middle of the church, that light source is hidden. So all you see is this light that cascades down this Bernini signature burst of Gloria, the gilt rays that come down towards the sculptural group. But here Bernini is trying to document this experience, this vision that Santa Teresa had, and I'm going to read for you this very short excerpt where she says that an angel who seemed to be all on fire with a golden spear, he plunged it into my heart, and I felt utterly consumed by the great love of God, the sweetness so severe one could not ever wish it to cease. So this is a very Baroque play trying to demonstrate and celebrate the bliss, the euphoria, which would be regarded as a potential result of being a participant in the Christian faith. And that's what's being celebrated here, the propaganda art of the age of the Baroque. I can remember taking my wife to see this piece when we were in Rome for our honeymoon. And frankly, it gave her the creeps. There's a lot of translations and recitations about this piece which talk about the sexual overtones of the posture, of the expression. It has my mind going back to that old movie When Harry Met Sally, and they're in the restaurant and she says, "I'll have what she's having." You know, I think there's some with the sightless eyes, with the state of rapture that she's in. But really what Bernini is doing is trying to communicate this consummate bliss and euphoria that was experienced by this woman. And when you see the details of how the facial features are articulated and the modeling of the stone, the delicacy of how it's handled, it's truly irresistible. But the real drama, the real charm of this visit to Santa Maria della Vittoria comes when you step back and you consider that this drama that's being played out, this Baroque love of theater, of action, actually is taking over the whole chapel. Where if you look to the left and the right of the Coronaro Chapel, we see members of the Coronaro family, both the patrons and deceased members of the Coronaro family, are sculpted and are depicted in these illusionistic galleries that are on the left and the right. And they're hovering and discussing in those boxes there the interplay that's going on before them. So when we considered Michelangelo's David, that drama was right in front of us for us to contemplate. But when you consider Baroque sculpture, what Bernini's yielding here, we see that theater actually is occupying space where there's sculptures that are interacting with other elements of the art that further energize the storytelling that's being engaged upon here. Now we'll be stepping out of Santa Maria della Vittoria, but we're staying atop the Quirinale Hill and traveling only, I want to say, about 200 yards to consider Bernini's his favorite of his architectural accomplishments, and that's San Andrea alla Quirinale, this little Baroque gem that's right opposite Borromini's San Carlo alle Quattro Fontane. And you have to consider these two buildings together when you go visit in person, because these were bitter rivals. But we see some Baroque elements, the curvilinear portico with a broken pediment at its peak, very traditional looking pediment at the very top of the facade. We also see what we associate with the Baroque, the complex array of planes, the return from the facade to the drum of the building with the little outcroppings and that kind of motion, very typical of the age of the Baroque. And when we get inside, we see what we expect from Bernini. We see gilt stucco decoration, an oval dome, the ovals of very Baroque form. We see sculptural adornment along the base of the dome with little amorini frolicking about the windows. We see a sculpture of St. Andrew as sort of the elevation of St. Andrew's spirit as it interrupts the curvilinear tympanum, which is above the altarpiece, polychrome marbles. Boy, your eye has no place to rest when you go inside San Andrea alla Quirinale. But the next time you go, be mindful of the fact that this actually was Bernini's favorite architectural achievement. And that there was one evening where he was passing by, heading down to the Gesù for his nightly participation in Vespers, where he stopped in and took a seat, and his son Domenico came in to follow to find his dad sitting right there in the pew. "Dad, what are you doing here?" He said, "I find a special amount of joy in my heart for the building of San Andrea alla Quirinale." So it's nice to know what the artist's favorite works were. His favorite sculpture was the Ecstasy of Santa Teresa. And he distinguished it by saying it was the least awful thing he ever did. The least awful thing he ever did. Isn't that something? All right, we're going to take a very quick buzz by Il Barcaccia, the little old unsinkable boat which teeters and floats at the base of the Spanish Steps. I think I'm running short on time, so we're going to make a very quick stop here. This was Bernini's first fountain design in Rome, executed in 1627. Okay, 1627, so early in Bernini's career that early attributions had it going to his dad, Pietro Bernini. And Maffeo Barberini, as cardinal before elevating to pope, had an occasion to confront Pietro Bernini as Gian Lorenzo's star was rising with his reputation and his David, his Apollo and Daphne. And he said to Pietro, the father, "You better be careful, Pietro. This could be one of those situations where the student outshines the master." Oh, but Pietro shook his finger at Maffeo and says, "Indeed, however, this is the only competition where the loser wins." A wonderful anecdote about parenting and how the least that we hope for our kids is that they can surpass what we're able to experience and enjoy in our lifetimes. Okay, our tour is winding down, and we're going to stop for a moment on my favorite bridge to cross, the Ponte San Angelo, because it means that I'm on my way to either the Musei Vaticani or to visit St. Peter's, leaving from my home in Rome, the Hotel Due Torri. And in 1670, it was Pope Clement IX who came to Bernini and said that he wanted to embellish the Ponte San Angelo in a way that would prepare pilgrims for their visit to San Pietro. And so Bernini decides to design a group of 10 angels, which mark the archways of the bridge. And each one of these angels is depicted holding one of the attributes of Christ's passion. So symbols of Christ's love for mankind, symbols of his suffering and his sacrifice so that we may be saved from our own sins. However, Bernini designed all 10 of the sculptures, but he wanted to make sure that he had his hand on the work of this bridge. So he actually sculpted two of the angels himself. He sculpted the angel of the crown of thorns, and then also the angel of the superscription being that banner that was on top of Jesus' crucifix. Now, when it was unveiled to Pope Clement IX, he was thrilled with the work. However, he felt Bernini's two angels were too fine to be left outside in the elements. So he commissions two copies to be made of those two angels, and those two angels were removed and moved indoors. Santa Maria della Frate, I think. However, Bernini continued to want his hand on the bridge. So he actually sculpted one of the copies himself, the angel of the superscription. When Pope Clement IX is aware of this, again, feigning displeasure, "Gian Lorenzo, you forced me to have to commission a copy to be made of the copy." So again, it's another instance where Bernini just shows this flair of having a charming, charismatic interaction with his patrons in a way that Michelangelo never was able to attain, and a way that helped bolster his position as the premier artist of his century. Now we're going to conclude this evening talking about this point I made about Gian Lorenzo Bernini, diplomat, ambassador. And this really is a departure from what we expect from our artists. When Bernini was in his 60s, so we're talking about 1660, relations between the Holy See and Rome and France are strained, as they were periodically in this period. So they decide to loan Bernini to Louis XIV as a way of massaging this relationship. So think about this. Think about an artist being used to broker international affairs. Think about the number of artists where this would be a complete disaster. I mean, what would happen if we sent Jeff Koons to Afghanistan? I mean, I shiver to think. However, it's a credit to this incredible range of Bernini, that not only was he a super talent, but he had this grace, this eloquence that allowed him to move very comfortably in these upper crust circles. While in Paris, he sculpts this incredible triumphant royal bust of Louis XIV with the drapery charged and the wonderful ringlets and the hair, a product of 13, 14 sittings, about 40 work days to execute the piece. Also while in Paris, he offers up a design proposal for the east facade of the Louvre. He executes something which is, you know, fabulously Baroque, extremely Italian, and very un-French. And it's no surprise that they snub their nose at it, especially when you consider the design that they arrived at, very classical, very, very traditional, and very French. So we see, now that we're at the end of this adventure accompanying Gian Lorenzo Bernini through beautiful Rome, we see that it's a different kind of range. He doesn't have the masterpieces in painting that Michelangelo can boast. But we see a range where this grace, this eloquence, gives him a different side to him, so that the range is different, but it's equally as impressive, I think. And I think makes it very justifiable, this title, Gian Lorenzo Bernini, Michelangelo of the Baroque. All right, thank you very much for your attention. I'm very happy to be a part of this, basically a weekend celebrating the work of Bernini. There's some other events that are planned for Friday and Saturday. And so a great privilege to kick that off. And I guess this is the time where I'm hopefully take some questions. Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
I'm passing around pictures, since you used the portrait, the self-portrait. You don't need to have to keep the program information, but there's a nice copy of that self-portrait on this. So I'll be going around the audience if you just pass them back and forth. So first I'd like to thank Michael for that, and to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Michael Stair speaking about Gian Lorenzo Bernini, the Michelangelo of the Baroque. It's time for questions and answers.
Regarding the fountain of the Four Rivers, two questions. Where was this, did he specify the obelisk, and where was the source of the obelisk? And on the fourth one, you said the River Platte.
Rio Platte. Yeah, South America.
South America, okay. Yeah. So the Mississippi hadn't been discovered at that point, I guess.
Yeah. Possibly. Maybe he just felt that was a more appropriate quotation that he wanted to use for the fountain. Regarding the source of the obelisk, it was an obelisk that was recently unearthed and brought to Rome. It actually was lying in some location there in Rome and was in segments, that it actually had been broken and was reassembled to become part of the Four Rivers Fountain. Now, I can't recall exactly where it was, but I do recall in the research that it was already in Rome and that it was in pieces and had to be reassembled to be incorporated into this piece.
Next question.
Michael, will you give us a comment on the fragility of these fine sculptures? Because it is absolutely amazing to see that marble down through the centuries can sustain a public exposure, and still we don't see any damage.
Yeah. Well, are you speaking to like a piece like the Apollo and Daphne that has that frail element, very fragile-looking pieces? You know, sculpture is an art form that completely intimidates me, just because of the unforgiving nature of the materials, having to think of a three-dimensional form in a block and plan out the proportions. Now, you know, by looking at that sculpture, I know that the Carrara marble that they used was a softer stone, so it would be a little bit less brittle. But, you know, in terms of moving a piece like that, I would have to think that it would be extremely fragile. Now, we know locals here in the group that it was his Medusa, Bernini's Medusa, that just recently was here at the Fine Arts Museum, or at the Legion of Honor in San Francisco, which has some of the coiling snakes depicted in her, rendered as her hair as part of that piece. And, you know, how they packed that piece for travel from the Musee Capitolini, you know, I don't know. I mean, I can't speak to specifics about what the what that stone can endure, what its limitations are specifically. All I know is what I know by looking and seeing that that tremendous care and protection has to be taken because, you know, like I said, they couldn't use their standard chisels and mallets for fear of losing, you know, months worth of work. You know, so those were all those challenges that these great artists would have to face embarking on a sculptural work like the ones that we considered here this evening.
Thank you. And do you know how you spoke of a hand power drill? I think mm-hmm. it does seem so amazing. But how do you have any idea how they get that utter smoothness? Do they then use some sort of polishing material?
There would be like a rotten stone, which is a powder that would be used, rubbed on the surface like an abrasive, something similar to like a sandpaper that we would be familiar with today. So they would use powders to act as abrasives, rubbing the powders on the surface to go from the rough chisels. So think of the chisels as like varying combs, where the roughing out chisel would have spikes on it like this, very wide and big. And they would do the roughing out of the block where big chunks of stone are being removed. And then as the work gets finer and finer, the chisels have narrower and narrower teeth. And then the chisel heads themselves are more narrow, so they do that finesse work. And then for the final that final delicacy, it's all done with polishing and abrasives to rub that surface down with the powder coming down to the floor to get that incredible lifelike look of the flesh. But what I find exciting are situations, for instance, when you see the slaves, Michelangelo's slaves at the Louvre, and you see these beautifully polished figures, lifelike figures, but if you look at the bases, you can see Michelangelo's chisel work. Now, when we looked at Bernini's work today, there's no sign of the artist. He's invisible. In classical art, the artist is invisible. There's no brushstroke on a painting. There's no chisel mark on the stone. But what's exciting about the slaves at the Louvre is you can see those chisel marks. You can see Michelangelo's hand right there imparting those blows with the hammer. And to me, to have that presence of the artist's hand visible there is a wonderful accompaniment to that high polish, high finish of the figure itself.
Next question.
Was Bernini most of the time employed by the church, the Catholic Church?
You know, a vast number of his commissions were church-related, ecclesiastic commissions. We talked in the 1620s. He executes the David. He executes Apollo and Daphne, okay, a pagan story, and then Pluto, the rape of Proserpina, Pluto and Proserpina, okay, those pagan tales there. That's in the 1620s. Those would be the last, you know, non-religious works that he would do. As he moved it through his career, he was a very pious man, a devout Christian, going to Vespers every evening, and he found that those types of storytelling, those types of commissions were a waste of his time. So the majority of his work, the majority of his body of work are, you know, religious, ecclesiastic commissions, and that's where he felt his spirit most involved in the execution of the work.
I read that the Jesuits had an influence on Bernini, and that this was part of, you know, that they had an idea about how art should be used to dramatize the storytelling to go abroad. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that favorite church of his, San Andrea alla Quirinale, is a Jesuit building, and I think the Baroque is tailor-made for the Jesuits, which was an order that sought to get out and convert through education. It was an energetic order, and the energy that you perceive in the Baroque art, I think, is very appropriate for, you know, that message. Now, the mother church of the Jesuit order, the Gesù in Rome, is one of the first great Baroque buildings in Rome, with one of the most fabulous illusionistic ceilings in all of Rome. And I think some of the, Ignatius Loyola might have bristled at some of the decadence of the decoration. But the Baroque had its own plans for church decoration that followed. And I find it sort of compatible with this energetic mission of the Jesuit order, seeing all that incredible decoration there.
I think the new pope being from the Jesuits is going to support the there's time for one more question. Anybody like to ask the last question?
He must have had some amazing style to be able to have the confidence to carve leaves from Daphne and not chip any of the stones. Were there any mistakes in that, or
Well, I'm sure if there were, Bernini knew exactly where they were, and I'm also sure that it would be very difficult for us to spot them, because that's just very typical. The artist is seeing the minutiae, whereas we're seeing the entire package. You know, Bernini was a very adept coordinator of studio hands, where he was a good manager of his assistants. He had one, Antonio Razzi, I think was the last name, who was a very prolific assistant that did a lot of sculptural work through Rome, whereas Michelangelo did everything he could to limit the interference of assistants, because Michelangelo felt there was a spiritual relationship between the artist and the materials. And the more hands that got involved, the more that relationship could get polluted and the expression of the art could be jeopardized. So this is why the body of work of Bernini's is more extensive, because he was a good coordinator of studio hands and knew how to efficiently use them, whereas Michelangelo did all that he could to limit the assistants, you know, locking them out of the Sistine Chapel when he wasn't happy with the work that they were executing. I mean, the stories are legendary.
That was a legendary explanation of Bernini. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
And so ends another event of enlightened discussion at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year.